You're listening to KDNK's public affairs program coming up here. For land's sake, this is Bill Kite, your host. And today we are fortunate to have in the studio with us Mr. Dale Will. Welcome, Dale.
Thank you, Bill.
You know, it was about two years ago that you were in the studio here and we did a show with you. And a lot's happened in the last 2 years, hadn't it?
Oh, yeah. We try to stay busy.
Well, it seems like time just passes right on with or without us, so we'll try to catch up on a few things here today, and one of those things is the Crystal River, our better-known Crystal Valley Trail from Carbondale to Crested Butte. And before we do that, though, you have a new title since you were here last time. You're now Acquisitions Director, is that correct?
That's true.
What does that entail here?
Well, I've kind of gone back to the job I had when they hired me almost 20 years ago, where I was just talking to landowners and lining up deals, and we hadn't yet hired rangers and land managers and planners and all that kind of thing. So all that built up over the last 20 years, and I was never really born to manage such a big crew, and we all decided maybe I should just do what I was originally trained to do and turn the rest of it over to Gary Tenenbaum, who is our executive director now and does a great job.
Yeah, Gary's a good guy. I know him, and I think that's a good place for him. You know, is the Crystal River Valley Trail the most controversial thing you've been involved with open space and trails in Pitkin County?
I don't know if I'd say that. We find that whenever we're talking about a new trail, especially if there's folks that live near it, tends to generate some controversy. And when we first proposed to activate the trail on the old Rio Grande Railroad, the folks in Wingo Junction got pretty agitated about it and thought that it was going to ruin their world and such. And the irony about that is that after the trail's done, next thing we have the same folks asking us if they can connect their properties directly onto the trail, and they feature the trail in their real estate ads and things. So I think it's just change. It kind of gets people going.
Yeah, that's true. For all of us, sometimes change can be a little bit much. This is part of what Governor Hickenlooper called his Colorado 16 initiative. And this is rather dry, but I'm going to read it anyway from your online report here. The trail is a component of an envisioned recreation trail network across Colorado that promotes multimodal transportation and recreation-based tourism, as well as regional connections between communities. That's a mouthful. So how did this trail get associated with this Colorado 16 initiative?
Well, we've been working on it for years, and in fact, we signed an IGA with Gunnison County way back in 2006. That was an interesting project doing that, because we based that IGA on the IGAs that some of these mountain communities signed trying to get some of these mountain passes done. And way back in the 1800s, Lake County and Pitkin were working on Independence Pass together. Well, so we'd been at this for some time looking for a connection there, and when Governor Hickenlooper was soliciting proposals for the trails that would comprise the 16, we submitted this concept and it was accepted.
He says in the same document quoted again Governor Hickenlooper that it's all about connecting people to the outdoor delights that set Colorado apart as a special place. Aren't you a little concerned that maybe the delight might turn into fright with too many people using it?
Well, I guess that's all kind of relative. Our friend Kenny Frost would probably say that 4,000 in all of Colorado was about the right number.
Right.
But seriously, in our looks at the wildlife impacts of recreation, one of the things that has become clear is that humans on an established trail where the wildlife get used to where they are have a lot less of an impact than dispersed recreation, where everyone wants to go up some hidden valley somewhere or bag some peak, and now the 13ers and pretty soon the 12ers. And so given that we can't really stop people from moving to Colorado, there's a commerce clause in the United States Constitution. We think the best thing to do is manage the recreation and give people a defined place to recreate. At the same time, there's definitely places we don't want people, and if they're closed, why don't we close them for everybody and not just rely on kind of the crummy infrastructure to determine who gets to go where.
Right. The thing I saw, too, in the report was there's estimated to be about 10,000 users a year now, and I imagine that figure will go up. But, of course, people like me that go up to the end of the trail now and come back get counted twice.
Oh, you're talking about the Rio Grande Trail.
Yeah.
So, right.
So that's, do you expect that would be the same amount of people that would be using this trail?
Oh, it's hard to predict. My guess would be not that many, because one of the things that's generating use on the Rio Grande Trail, of course, is that the major municipalities of our valley are strung out along it. So Carbondale to Basalt to Aspen or to Glenwood, those are all connected on this trail. The Crystal Trail wouldn't have population centers that are as dense along the way. I think the Carbondale to Redstone lunch ride might become pretty popular, just as the Woody Creek Aspen lunch ride did, but I just don't see it ever reaching Rio Grande proportions.
Okay, well, it's what, 83 to 85 miles somewhere in there? Quite a long way if you want to do it in one day. You'd be be pretty huffing and puffing, wouldn't you?
Some of those are tough miles too.
They are.
I don't see anyone except the healthy few being able to take that in one sitting.
Now, there's been an awful lot of planning that's gone into previous documents here and previous endeavors. In 1994, there was a bicycle trail feasibility study, and then the West Elk Loop Scenic Byway study, and that resulted in a management plan and all kinds. White River National Forest had a 2002 management plan. So this is going to be the fruition of that, all that planning then, you think?
Well, certainly the planning set the stage for us to present this trail plan for consideration this summer. We've got a draft plan that's out for public comment. The county commissioners are going to be down in Carbondale on June 26th to hear more from people. But I can't really tell you what the plan's going to include, whether it includes a trail at all, by the time all the comments are in and the commissioners have a chance to deliberate on this.
So give us that timeline again so people that want to go to that can go.
June 26th, there's going to be a listening session in Carbondale with the county commissioners.
Okay.
But we're also accepting comments directly on the draft plan now if you go to Pitkin OST Projects.
And I believe that's where I found the document that I was referring to earlier, I believe. It's pretty easy to find.
Right. Pitkin OST Projects, and there's an incredible amount of information there. We've researched the wildlife and the history and the engineering and the costs, and all of that are combined in a draft plan that's over 100 pages. And anyone that loves the Crystal Valley might want to take a look at it, even if they don't care about the trail. There's a lot of great information there.
There really is. There's a lot of history, a lot of section of the report devoted to the history of that area, which is a very rich history that you and I both have been involved in. I appreciated that there wasn't anything left out to go over the sort of an overview of what's happened in that little valley. And, you know, it's interesting to me that you had steam engines going back and forth on that old railroad before it became the railroad bed and the rails were gone. And, you know, it seems to me that there's a lot of people that are concerned that the alignment use, if it comes out as a possible alternative, will it'll mess up the environment and harm wildlife. And yet, there was a time when these noisy steam engines, you know, rumbled down the track. So what's the big deal?
Well, of course, we've done a wildlife study, and that's available in detail for people that want to know a much longer answer than I can give you sitting right here. But at least a summary, in my opinion, having read all this stuff, is that a lot of that railroad grade in the summertime, it's not critical habitat. It is close enough to the highway that it's impacted by the highway, by the noise of cars going by. And also, there's a whole series of residential developments interspersed along in between pieces of public land along that way. So given that the baseline is not virgin wilderness, it's a highway corridor, well, with there's 100 houses on the east side of the river between the BRB and Redstone, for example, and I think there's 450 in the valley total. The question really is what is the incremental impact of allowing the general public the access to some of those places in a trail that's all linked together compared to what you have now, which is a lot of those railroad grade sections are being used by the immediate neighbors, but they're tricky to get to because they don't link together from the outside anymore. So I think the summer use of a lot of that is fairly benign. There's people that would debate that with me. Winter use is a whole different thing. And, you know, the Ute used to get out of that valley entirely in the winter, and probably the wildlife were better off for that. But like it or not, we've got year-round residences up and down that valley. Nonetheless, we recognize that elk and bighorn sheep and some of these other animals are at higher levels of stress, and food is scarce in the winter. So a lot of it we're proposing not to keep open during those months.
Well, reading all the articles I've read in the paper, a person could come away and feel like that there's a lot of NIMBYism going on here. And so I think, you know, that's something that a lot of us don't want more people where we live. We don't want people affecting what we consider sacred and important. But there's got to be some reasonableness in here of people willing to compromise and come up with the best solution. Do you see that on the horizon?
Well, I hope so. You know, I'm both an environmentalist, but I'm also an egalitarian, and I believe in the principles of our Declaration, which is all of us are created equal. So, you know, as I said earlier, I think if something is so important that people shouldn't visit it, it should be closed to everybody. And on the other hand, if there's a niche where after a amount of biological study you can conclude that some recreational use is not going to have a significant impact, then I'm all for humans being able to enjoy those places. We're of the earth and we have a part in it. As long as we're careful, we can occupy the part we have without harming the other life that's here.
It's not always an easy job, though, to manage recreation trails, preserve the habitat, and resolve human use conflicts. Are they compatible here?
Well, I think so if they're managed properly. We adopted a policy on the preservation of biodiversity, and the centerpiece of that policy is we look at the best available science, again, to look for where the niches are. If given the space that something needs or the time of year they need it, if the human presence is going to harm that species, and we've shown that with a scientific study, then we'd stay out of it. So, for example, at Sky Mountain Park, we've got the thing closed in the winter, and in the summer when it's open, we located those trails very carefully to avoid rare plants that they can't get out of the way, so we got out of their way. But I don't see any other choice for human beings to try to have their place on the planet if we're conscientious and we look at the science to find our place. And I'd also add, there's a lot of other things that go on in that valley that are potentially challenging for wildlife. Every time you twist the key in your ignition, you're harming the survival of a polar bear because you're warming up the climate. So if someone can get on a bicycle and get to the grocery store instead of driving their car, maybe there's less of an impact on wildlife for them to ride their bike down that railroad grade than to start their car up and rumble back and forth and spew the emissions out. So,
yeah, it's a really nice thing to live here in Carbondale where you can get on your bike. I've done it so many times, go to the grocery store, go to concert or, you know, whatever you want to do, you can just do it on your bike here. And I, there aren't a lot of places like this that you can actually enjoy a nice trail. I like going down the what's now put in for the Crystal River Trail, Crystal Valley Trail. I like it. I like it a lot, and I'd like to see it extended, in, of course, in an appropriate fashion. But there seems to be a tension between recreation and preservation, having been involved as I have in historic preservation. And you have the county has a biodiversity policy. Could you go into that a little bit?
Well, sure. Again, the core of our biodiversity policy is a belief in conservation biology and the science that comes out of some careful study. Just because someone has an anecdote that they've seen more or less animals in a given place, that doesn't necessarily show that there's a correlation with one type of human activity or another. So we try to study these things. I'd say that Pitkin County Open Space has spent more on wildlife studies in this valley in the last 20 years than any other government agency, including CPW or the Forest Service. We're fortunate to have the money to spend on these things, and we spent a pretty good amount looking at wildlife on the Crystal. We've spent comparable time and energy to look at wildlife at Sky Mountain Park and Smuggler Mountain and other places. So the biodiversity policy starts with the premise that, we're going to have scientists look at these places, and then we're going to sit back and look at those results. And if there's not space for human activity, whether it's recreation or agriculture or something else, then we're going to try to avoid it. But if an objective review of the science says that the impact of a human activity is not going to have an impact that's consequential to the survival of a species or of a community, then we think the humans have a place. So whenever someone comes in and says we ought to close this or that, or you shouldn't allow people here, my next question is, well, show me the science, you know.
Right.
Instead of show me the money, it's show me the science.
Right. A lot of this proposed trail goes across national forest, as a matter of fact, two different national forests. Do you think the Forest Service has any skin in this game? I mean, they're going to have to do environmental assessment or possibly even an EIS?
Certainly. If the result of this trail plan proposes alignments on the forest, then that will trigger all the federal environmental review that's required for those uses. And interestingly enough, the section in Gunnison County over in the Gunnison National Forest was integrated into their travel management plan, and so there's less of that NEPA and other things that need to be done to get from the top of McClure Pass over Kebler and into Crested Butte. But on our side, the travel management plan was done a little later, and these routes were not integrated into it. So we're starting from scratch. And from our contacts with the Forest Service, they've been very interested in this planning, and they understand they're essentially on standby to see what plan is adopted. And once we know, the pieces on the forest will be going through the appropriate levels of environmental review.
There are already a few trails that this trail will sort of open up more, or at least give access to. One's the Purim Creek Trail, which I really like. That's right now is not a good time to go there. It's pretty hot against those cliffs. But what are some of the other trails that are going to be more accessible, you think?
Well, we don't look at this particular trail as connecting a lot of side trails. It will connect some open spaces that are potentially connect them that are presently fairly isolated. Potential connections would be this Crystal Parcel number 1 that's up against the BRB, the Red Wind Point. There's some national forest sections that people are currently using, but they're not connected. Avalanche Creek, I guess, the main one. The old grade down in and out of Janeway that is used by neighbors. And
right.
And then getting up on the other side of Redstone, that's where the old wagon road had crossed and probably the Ute Trail before it. But there's a section up past Bear Creek that's pretty nice, but more of a of a locals hangout that would be connected and become more used. And then finally, the switchbacks up on McClure Pass. So again, all this dependent upon the final alignments chosen. And the plan we have now out for public comment proposes to first try to finish the section from Redstone to the top of McClure Pass. And then these sections below Redstone, which frankly have generated more controversy, the plan really is a scheduling for future planning on the details, where some of these alignments won't be known for years until we get to the particular sections and undergo the planning for those.
In some places, it's going to be quite difficult to build trails. What kind of price is associated with this trail from the cheapest version to the most expensive? What kind of price tag are we looking at here?
Oh, boy. Well, it's pretty widespread in the plan. And speaking in general terms, if you can use an existing platform like the old Rock Creek Wagon Road or the Crystal Railroad grade, it's a fraction of the cost of building a new platform. And so therefore, if you delve into the plan, you'll see that building something along the edge of the highway is up to 10 times more expensive. Just as an example, that little section between Avalanche Creek and Penny Hot Springs and what's called the Narrows, I'm going to get this number a little bit wrong, but it's a magnitude of about 10 times more. It's several hundred thousand to put it on the old grade, and it's pushing $10 million to try to hang something on the side of that highway.
So
the highway's not going to be cheap, and then there's the issue of the visual impacts of trying to do that too. Using the old grade for a trail, frankly, isn't going to create much visual change to what's there now, but adding something on the side of the highway, you're thinking in terms of what's in Glenwood Canyon. It's an engineering feat to get some of that to go. Now, in the draft plan too, there's some consideration to simply widening the shoulders of the highway, and we put that in to show another option. I'll leave it to the people that want to comment with whether that's really the kind of trail you want, where you've got the kind of traffic we do that's going right by your elbow. But in any event, it's in there to show a less expensive choice that's nonetheless still in the highway side of the river.
Over the years, I've seen more and more weird things happen in the form of technology that have allowed people to extend themselves on the landscape. When it was used to be just motorcycles, and then it became ATVs, and then there's all kinds of other things that have come along. What kind of restrictions would there be on that trail? Is it just for pedestrians and bicycles and horse people? I can see some hovercraft coming around here in the future that you'd have to deal with, because I know that does happen.
Well, you're correct. The starting out premise is we're talking about non-motorized recreation that is for muscle-powered sports, whether they're hiking or equestrians or bicycles. Now, everyone that's been reading the papers realizes the e-bike has come of age, and it's kind of a hybrid of muscle and electric power, and we're now looking at Class 1 e-bikes, which are pedal-assisted e-bikes for the other trail. Interestingly enough, there's studies out of Boulder County and other places that some of our older people, which you and I are getting into that category, get more exercise if they have an e-assist. They're more likely to get on their bike and go. So I think there's arguments on both sides of the e-bike discussion, but I'm sympathetic to anything that helps a person get outside and get some exercise. I don't see anything beyond the possibility of e-bikes winding up on the trail.
We really appreciate you coming in today, Dale. It's been a pleasure again to have you. Maybe we can have you again. It won't be as long a period of time between you and the next appearance here. So thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Great. Thanks, Bill. I'm always happy to come in.
You've been listening to It's For Land's Sake. This is Bill Kite, your host, and join us on the second Tuesday of every month. And until then, whatever you do to Mother Earth, do it for land's sake.